My name is Tom Witt, and this session is entitled The Color of War, How Racism Fuels Militarism. So if you're looking for hunger, why and how, and that's in the other room. It's interesting that these two things are slotted against each other. It's not a very uplifting hour to choose from, but I think that they'll both be interesting. I'm actually doing two sessions, one tonight and one tomorrow morning at 10:30. Tonight is on the connection between racism and militarism, and tomorrow is on the connection between sexism and militarism. And the two sessions relate to each other, but they stand on their own. Tonight I'm going to be talking about a number of things that really have been said by many other people, and most forcefully, I think, by Martin Luther King Jr., particularly at the end of his ministry in the last 2 years of his life. Many of us don't realize, I think, what we live with. Because he's a national hero now, we sort of smooth over Martin Luther King and think of his I Have a Dream speech, whereas in the last year, especially of his life, Martin Luther King was making a lot of connections that made him really a beleaguered public figure. He was making, he was particularly speaking very strongly against the war in Vietnam. He was encouraging conscientious objection and draft resistance. He was criticizing our nation's military policies as well as our military budget and our intervention in third world countries. And he's known, of course, as a great figure engaged in the struggle for rights for black people, but he realized that the black movement was forcing America to face all of its interrelated flaws, not just racism, but militarism and materialism and poverty. So King was really calling for a much broader revolution, and I think some of that is very important to what I want to say tonight, because whether we like it or not, this is what King was about. This is the kind of connections he was making right before he died, and what he was about, I think, has something to do with why he died. He was making some very serious connections between militarism and racism that were perceived, I think, to be quite threatening to the powers that be. And I think if we're to struggle with the meaning for Martin Luther King for us today, that we need to struggle with those connections, particularly the one between racism and militarism. I want to make 4 points tonight in the short amount of time that we have together, and I hope you all have these sheets that I set out. And maybe if someone near the door could be the person who makes sure that people get those when they come in. And this is simply reinforcing, I think, what King and so many others have said. 4 points. One, that racism is a fuel for militarism, and that U.S. foreign policy is essentially racist. It's a hard word to hear, but I think that that's true. Secondly, that militarism is the primary vehicle that carries out racist practices. Thirdly, that people of color are most often the victims of militarism, both here and abroad. In other words, the reason that there's so much militarism is that it has some so-called positive effects, I think, for white people, greater power, more things to accumulate. It has some negative consequences for people of color, and it hits them the hardest. Maybe up on the balcony, you could mention that there's a session down here, just so that they know. And then fourthly, that it's impossible to completely separate out foreign and domestic policy, because they are mirrors of one another and they play off of each other. And I think one of the basic messages of both is that people of color are expendable. And so that's what I want to take a look at, and do that by way of this sheet that I handed out, which is a very brief historical look at racism and militarism in United States history. So if you can have this just to refer to, I'm just going to, as quickly as possible, go through this in historical fashion. That's my background, American history and American studies, and I want to look at this in the historical context and remind you that we're going to take a look at history from a particular perspective. We're going to look at it from the perspective of people of color. And to remind you that this is one way of looking at history. It's not the only way, it's just one way. And it is biased, like all views of history. So just to be patient with that, it's a difficult history to hear for us as white people, but I think it's one that we need to hear. It's one that we don't often hear. So I'm going to go through this, and if you can think of the right side of your page as being sort of domestic issues and the left side being more foreign policy issues, that will be helpful. The first two events actually are in the wrong place. They really should be straddling that middle line. The first two events really relate, the first two events in pre-revolutionary America relate to both foreign policy, militarism issues, and racism in this country. And the first is the inhumane treatment of Native American peoples from the very beginning of the occupation and the arrival of European peoples, and heightened particularly with the English occupation. Just tremendous, tremendous violence against Native peoples. And the second one is the arrival of the first slave ships in 1619. By 1850, it's estimated, this is an incredible statistic to me, by 1850 it was estimated that 10 to 15 million blacks had been transported as slaves to America, and that represents perhaps one-third of those originally seized in Africa. So 10 to 15 million blacks had come to be slaves. That represented just one-third of the number originally seized in Africa. Now, I've read this in a number of different places. It seems quite impossible, but it really points to a Holocaust of almost 20 million blacks who died just en route to in the slave trade. And this apparently was still profitable for slave owners to have so many die, but just the conditions on the ships coming over. And it's something we don't often think about in terms of a Holocaust. We talk about the Jewish Holocaust, which is certainly devastating. This was quite a few more. I'm going to move quickly down here, starting with the Revolutionary War, and just kind of highlight some of the issues that may help us understand the connections between racism and militarism. Start with the Revolutionary War, which really was not a popular war, especially among people of color. It did not have any positive effects or consequences for people of color. In fact, it might have been worse for them, because after the war, it allowed Americans to forget about the oppression of the British and to begin their own sort of oppression through expansion of slavery and removal of Indian people as they moved westward. One of the analyses of the war is that it was really fought in the interest of colonial rich who wanted control of their land. Many of the people who led the war were rich people living with, who were big landholders. It in no way really intended to radically change the way things were in the colonies. After the war, there were still property restrictions. The country was still ruled by the elites. In fact, one of the first acts after the Declaration of Independence was to institute a draft, which rich people could avoid by paying for substitutes. I think it didn't necessarily have a great effect on people of color. The War of 1812, similarly, I think is depicted in a different way than people of color understand it. It's depicted in U.S. history as a war against England for survival, but was actually a war of expansion of the new nation into Florida, into Canada, into Indian territory. This is the time when Andrew Jackson became a national hero. When in 1814 he fought a battle against the Creek Indians and killed 800 of them with a few casualties on his side. That's how Andrew Jackson became a public figure in the United States. During that period from about 1814 to 1824, whites took over much of the Southeast, Georgia, Mississippi, parts of Kentucky, and North Carolina. And Jackson brought whites to the border of Florida, and then he literally decimated the Seminole Indian population with raids into Florida, arguing that Florida was a sanctuary for escaped slaves and marauding Indians. And Florida, he said, was essential to the defense of the United States. And this begins, in U.S. history, a classic twist that you begin to rephrase a war of conquest into terms of self-defense. Actually, it's a war of conquest, but you just phrase it in terms of self-defense. Under Jackson and then under Martin Van Buren, about 70,000 Indians were forced westward out of that territory. And you begin to see the racism of some of our American history texts, where Andrew Jackson, you always hear about Jackson, the frontiersman, the soldier, the Democrat, the man of the people. Never do we read about Jackson, the slaveholder, the land speculator, the exterminator of Indian people. And I think that that's important to realize, is that we hear one side of that history, and people of color view it differently. Now looking at the other side of the sheet again, in 1823, expansion overseas begins early in America. In 1823, the Monroe Doctrine comes at the time when Latin American countries were beginning to win independence from Spain. Same time, the United States declares that Latin America was in its sphere of influence. So already American armed forces have gone outside of the U.S. The State Department lists 103 interventions in the affairs of other countries between the years of 1798 and 1895, most of them in Latin America. So already you're beginning to have expansion outside of our country in terms of military intervention. This is probably best described by the term manifest destiny. I'm sure many of you have heard this term. It became very popular during the mid-1800s in this sort of way. It was written that America's manifest destiny is to overspread and to possess the whole of the continent which Providence, capital P, Providence, has given us for the free development of our yearly multiplying millions. So this was really the attitude that somehow it was God's will that we just spread all over the continent, primarily white people. So if you begin to see racism as the assumption, and either the unconscious or conscious assumption, that everything should be run for the benefit of whites, you begin to see clear manifestations of this in our history and how this has played out in all sorts of government policies on many different levels. But militarism is the primary vehicle by which that philosophy of manifest destiny is carried out.
What was the dates again, Tom?
1845 was when that first became, a phrase.
You gave a figure of 100 interventions between...
103 interventions between the years 1798 and 1895 outside of our borders. Most of those in Latin America. The best example of this would be the war against Mexico, in which the United States stole about half of what was once Mexico in their quest to expand territory. And in particular, it's interesting that it was part of a plan to expand southern slave territory. Mexico had earlier abolished slavery in 1821. The United States annexed Texas in 1836, and it became a slave state in 1845. 1846, the next year, full-scale war broke out with Americans killing Mexicans on their own soil and taking away their land. Now, the rhetoric of that war was very different that you read about in the papers. It was more in terms of the United States would be giving the blessings of liberty and democracy to more people. In reality, it was a war of racial superiority, a commercial enterprise, land grabbing, and our need to civilize another country. People really saw that it was our destiny, the destiny of the white race, to march from ocean to ocean. By the way, the churches during this time were all either very supportive of the war against Mexico, or they were silent at this time in the mid-1800s. After the Mexican War, the United States had its way cleared through the Southwest all the way to California. It was during this time that New Mexico was carved out, and I'm not sure, it may just be coincidence, but New Mexico is still one of the states that has the largest Native American population and Hispanic population. It is also the most militarized of our states, given the Sandia Labs and Los Alamos and many of the toxic waste dumps and nuclear weapons sites. I don't know whether that's a coincidence or not, but this move westward led to also a massive repression of Mexican people who, like the Indians, at one time were guaranteed their liberties and then were lied to. In 1849, part of the great gold rush in California, the state of California declared null and void all mining claims previously held by Mexicans during that time. So it was a tremendous repression during that time by Mexicans who were living in parts of what now are California. From the years, on the other side, from the year 1790 to about 1860, slavery grew from about 500,000 to 4 million. Even though slave importation became illegal in the year 1808, that law was virtually ignored. So slaves grew from about 500,000 to 4 million during those years. The Civil War was, of course, the one that abolished slavery, but it's important, I think, to understand from people of color's viewpoint, it was not a war that was fought on behalf of black slaves. It was a war fought to keep the nation together, whatever that meant. And Lincoln, if you read about him, you know that for a long time, Lincoln would have been willing to allow slavery in the South if it meant unity. Lincoln always refused to publicly denounce the fugitive slave laws. In the North at that time, blacks could not vote unless they had over $250 worth of private property. Many of them did not. Again, rich whites were able to buy their way out of the draft for about $300, sometimes forcing free blacks to fight. And it's interesting, if any of you have seen the movie Glory, which I thought was an excellent movie, is one thing that did not point out is that many blacks were forced to fight in that war because whites bought their way out of the war, and blacks were forced to fight because economic reasons. And that's one of the things that I was sad that movie did not bring out. And there were lots of riots during that time. I think it's still the largest loss of life due to domestic violence in this country occurred during this time when hundreds and hundreds of people were killed in anti-draft riots in 1863. Many of them were black people. The kind of liberation that blacks received after the Civil War was certainly top-down. It did not sort of radically reach out and restructure society. But it would go. The restructuring went so far only as white people were willing to permit it. After the Civil War, the positive changes for blacks were limited. By 1876, Reconstruction really had ended, and the Ku Klux Klan had begun to consolidate its political power, its influence, opening up lynching now in the South. If you look back on the sheet, now having settled the internal disputes and unified the nation now, white folks continue their task of expanding the empire. On the right side of the sheet, you see that during the late 1800s, this is when the East-West Railroad was built, making it lots easier to take over Indian territory. By the way, the East-West Railroad, which is a very, very important development, was built largely by Chinese slave-type labor. And at one point in California, then, Chinese really became about a tenth of the population and were objects of lots of violence. And in 1882, finally, considering that Chinese were undesirable, the state of California began really policies of discrimination, and then the United States ended immigration of Chinese for a period of 25 years. So many Chinese helped build that railroad, and then when that job was done and they became too numerous, they were considered to be a threat. By the end of the century, what you have then is that the Indian people were pretty much driven off the Western Plains. They were confined to reservations. The climax of 400 years of violence against Native people was at Wounded Knee about 100 years ago, when 300 men and women and children were massacred. And basically, Indian people see this as a restatement of what Columbus said, that the continent belonged to white people. This was just a restatement of what they had experienced over and over again. So Indians were confined to reservations. Blacks were liberated from slavery, but now pretty much locked into the plantation system of the South as sharecroppers and tenant farmers. Manifest Destiny had moved whites to the western border of the U.S., so now the U.S. was ready to concentrate more thoroughly on expansion overseas. And this is largely then through military conquest. And then what we begin to see is that people of color, again, are the primary victims of as the U.S. starts to then export racism outside of its borders. A good example of this is 1896, the war against Spain. During this time, from about 1899 to 1904, in that time, the United States conquered Puerto Rico, Cuba, Guam, Hawaii, and the Philippines. And it brings up a theme that you can see clearly now, I think, currently in Central America, that expansion and invasion is always made to look like an act of generosity. So you sort of promise to help a group of rebellious people overthrow a dictator or a ruler, and because of that, it's always possible to kind of create a national mood for intervention because it seems like it's an act of generosity. And this was true in the case of Cuba, which the United States helped overthrow Spain, but then in essence replaced Spain as the occupier with its military bases, investments, and then the United States had the right to intervene at any time it wanted. And incidentally, one of the reasons that America took over Cuba was the fear that it would become another black republic like Haiti. So as essentially racist kinds of things. The Philippines, what they call the so-called pacification of the Philippines in the late 1890s was perhaps, I think, one of the most blatantly racist wars right at the turn of the century. McKinley was president at the time, and he claims that God, he had a dream, and that God told him one night that, quote, "There was nothing left for us to do but to take them all and to educate the Filipinos and uplift and civilize and Christianize them, and by God's grace do the very best we could by them as our fellow men for whom Christ also died. And then I went to bed and went to sleep and slept soundly." And this is the dream that McKinley had. And following this then was 3 years that it took to crush the Filipino rebellion using 70,000 U.S. troops and a tremendous number of Philippine casualties. It's interesting, I read a little bit of the Senate debate about the war against the Philippines, and it's tremendous racist language. At one point, someone says, "It has been charged that our conduct of the war has been cruel. Senators, it has been the reverse. We must remember that we are not dealing with Americans or Europeans. We are dealing with Orientals." All sorts of that kind of language that assumed that the Pacific was ours to invade, ours to control, that it was sort of an open door to the East. The atrocities in the Philippines really were the forerunner to what happened in Vietnam in this century. Dum-dum bullets, torture of prisoners, mutilation of bodies by U.S. troops, massive killings of civilians and soldiers, really was like Vietnam in that sense. Also, the Philippine War was the first time that large numbers of black U.S. black soldiers fought. And this was for a variety of reasons, a lot of them economic, that it was a way to get out of poverty. It was also, I think, a lot of advertisement about the excitement of war. There was some race pride, the need to show that blacks were just as courageous and patriotic as anyone else. But what's interesting that happened is that a lot of the black soldiers there began to build rapport with the brown people of the Philippines and were angered by the term nigger used by white soldiers to describe Filipinos. And as blacks and Filipinos began to talk, a lot of black soldiers, significant number, began to desert. Because Filipinos began reminding blacks of lynchings back home and said, "Why are you a part of this white war against us?" I thought that was really interesting. I'd never heard that before. Now, at the same time that this was happening back home, U.S. militarism was being mirrored in this country. It's time of tremendous violence against black people. The years 1889 to 1903 was some of the most intense racism in our history. On the average, every week, several Negroes were lynched by mobs, hanged, burned, mutilated. All the time then, blacks were preached, "Be patient, have moderation." At the same time, whites were preached, patriotism, jingoism, imperialism. So, and about the same time, the United States was creating the so-called independent state of Panama, in which this literally gave the U.S. a zone of colonial domination in a country that had just won its independence from Colombia. But you see here how that through military interventions, the racism that's pervasive throughout the United States is introduced elsewhere. So this whole pattern is then just transported, exported to Panama, where you now have separate and unequal pay scales for Panamanian and U.S. citizens in the canal zone. There's segregated housing, there's segregated schools, there's a separate judicial system. And then Panama becomes a quickly a spot for U.S. military bases, and then the training of police and military personnel for later on for excursions into other parts of Latin America and the Caribbean. Okay, I'm moving, trying to move as quickly as possible just to sort of get through this and then have some discussion. World War One, with World War One coming in 1914, if you look at the sheet, you begin to see sort of a pattern of the periodic war. If you see how the wars are spaced out, I think this is really interesting because it seems as though war and militarism is used in a way to divert attention in order to create some national consensus around an external enemy. And this has really become one of the ways in which the United States has dealt with internal unrest over our history. That you create this fighting purpose among people who are torn by internal conflict. And this is another way in which I think war is racist, because war becomes a way to disrupt social movements for change by the use of the psychology of patriotism, the lure of adventure, the spirit of moral crusade. All of that works really effectively. Militarism putting a damper on class resentments and dissatisfaction among poor people and people of color against the rich and powerful. Instead, that anger gets turned outwards towards some sort of definable enemy. And you can see this all the way through American history, from the Revolution to the Cold War, that the United States really does need international rivalry or the periodic war to kind of create this artificial community of interest between rich and poor and black and white. So I just sort of keep that in mind, that that's one of the patterns that we see, is that there's periodic wars to distract people from what's going on in our country. World War I is a real example of this. You think about it, 10 million people died in World War I. 20 million died of hunger and disease related to the war, without the war really bringing any sense of gain for humanity. The real roots of the war, again, were economic and racist. W. Du Bois called it a war of empire in which there was a struggle between Western Europe nations to carve up Africa and to go for the gold and diamonds of South Africa and the cocoa of Angola, Nigeria, and I don't know, Jane, you could tell us what they took from Western Africa, whether it was palm oil or whatever, but that's when a lot of Africa was carved up. Of course, in order to pull that off, war makers begin to have to put tremendous public relations efforts into supporting war, with tremendous pressure against those who oppose war. This is when the Espionage Act was passed, and you could be arrested in this country for any kind of opposition to the war effort. In spite of that pressure, there were 65,000 conscientious objectors to World War I who demanded alternative service. But there was tremendous pressure during World War I. Moving right along, the 1920s, domestically saw the spread of the Ku Klux Klan again, which spread to the north. By 1924, it had 4.5 million members. Either blacks were openly oppressed or simply ignored, especially as the Depression came along in the 30s, that many of them were not, because they were tenant farmers and migrants, a lot of them didn't qualify for all of the sort of New Deal programs that Roosevelt put together. Also, Congress sets up immigration quotas now that clearly favor white or Anglo-Saxon people and kept out large numbers of black and yellow people from this country, severely limiting the influx of Latin people, of Slavs, of Jews. No African country during this time could send more than 100 people a year to this country. There was 100 for China, 100 for Bulgaria and Palestine, while at the same time 34,000 a year were allowed to come from England and 51,000 a year from Germany. So in those immigration laws, there's clearly reflects racism. World War II is difficult to talk about because it's the one sort of war that we think of as the People's War, that was clearly fought against an unspeakable evil, totalitarianism and racism and militarism. But The question I think is really important to ask about World War II is, did the United States in its involvement represent something significantly different from what we were opposing? So that with a U.S. victory in the war, would that be a blow to militarism and racism and imperialism and totalitarianism? Would that be a blow if the United States won that war? Again, the way you look at it, the United States was perceived by probably by much of the world as the defender of helpless countries, fighting to defend principles of non-intervention and protecting countries from being intervened. But when you look at our history, it's difficult to see that because we had invaded so many times. But it was clear at the time that Germany was a dictatorship persecuting a Jewish minority. It was imprisoning dissidents, no matter what the religion was, while proclaiming the superiority of the Aryan race. It was a tremendous evil. So the United States was coming to fight that, but it's important to understand, I think, and again from the perspective of Jewish people, perspective of other people of color, the United States entry into World War II was not about ending oppression of Jews. The United States did very little to oppose Hitler's policy during the 30s when it could have. Roosevelt was about as concerned for Jews as Lincoln was concerned to end slavery. And it wasn't the attack on Jews that brought the United States into World War II, just like it wasn't the enslavement of 4 million blacks that brought us into the Civil War. What brought us into the World War II was the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, which was an attack on the Pacific Empire. The question that I have and that other historians have is, was the United States fighting primarily because they thought Hitler was wrong in his idea of Nordic supremacy? Was that the reason the United States was fighting in World War II? And I think it's really hard to say yes when you see at that time that U.S. armed forces were still segregated by race. Troops were crammed onto ships going to Europe with blacks stored down in the depths of the ship near the engine room with very little fresh air, which was really reminiscent of slave ships. That time the Red Cross still separated blood donations by black and white. Despite the urgent need for labor in the United States, blacks and other minorities were still discriminated against for jobs, often only considered for janitorial jobs. And on one of its policies, the United States, in fact, came close to reproducing, duplicating fascism in its treatment of Japanese Americans living in this country in the West Coast. I mean, in this tremendous anti-Japanese American frenzy, the army was given power to arrest every Japanese American on the West Coast. 110,000 of them were taken from their homes, transported into camps far in the interior, and kept under prison conditions. And of course, now we look at this as a sort of a mistaken judgment, but you wonder if it was really a mistake or whether it was sort of a policy to be expected from a nation that had a long history of racism. So, you know, you have to ask, was the United States fighting a war to end domination by some nations over other nations, or were we simply fighting to make sure that the dominating nations were friends of ours? I think that we could have a lot of discussion about that, and I think that's not the only view of World War II, but it certainly is one that has to be considered. Of course, one of the clearest racist consequences of the war was, in fact, the action which allegedly ended the war, the obliteration of two primarily civilian targets, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And we don't have time to go into all the reasons why those cities were bombed, whether what was really militarily necessary or whether it was assigned to the Russians. But I sometimes wonder, would we have dropped that bomb so quickly if those were white people? Perhaps we would have, because many of the saturation bombings in Europe were just as devastating. But I think we might have thought a little bit more carefully if those were not Asian people. Very quickly, just sort of after the war, the beginning of the atomic age, a lot of Americans, not necessarily people of color, but a lot of Americans found that there was a rejuvenated economy, there was a lot more stability in the country, there were big profits, and a public that had by and large been distracted from lots of the internal tensions that had been evident a decade earlier. And in the eyes of rich Americans, we did solve some problems with World War II, and recognizing that there became this continuing alliance between business and the military to form a permanent war economy. And the Truman administration did, I think, work hard to create an atmosphere of crisis and Cold War hysteria to make the Soviet Union an immediate threat, and thereby justifying more militarism and squelching opposition to it. So this is how sort of the permanent war economy is born, and this is really where the domino theory is invented, that from here on in, every revolutionary movement is described to the American people as Soviet expansionism and creeping communism, whether that's in Latin America, whether it's in Southern Africa, whether it's in Southeast Asia. This enables now for us to be aggressive militarily in other parts of the world, and also to repress people who are opposed to that kind of militarism. McCarthyism, of course, died out after a while, but the Cold War was still alive, at least up until recently, and I think to some extent today. The 1950s, domestically, I'm not going to say too much about that, other than that, there are some strides for racial equality in this country, but also lots and lots of racism still, and tremendous disparity between the conditions for blacks and whites, although not as much disparity as we have now. I think the important thing to point out about the 60s, late 50s and early 60s, is the peace movement and the opposition to the Vietnam War really came out of the civil rights movement that was bubbling. And I don't think we realize that there's not always a separation between the peace movement and the civil rights movement, but the beginnings of the opposition to the war in Vietnam really came from civil rights leaders. Who apparently didn't trust our nation's motives in Vietnam. As far as the Vietnam War goes, I think most people can probably figure out the racism of that war. It's not altogether different from previous wars. The continuity, though, I think is striking. The idea of bombing Vietnam into the Stone Age, which was one of the terms used, and the idea that the only good Indian is a dead Indian, those come from two different centuries, but it's sort of part of one unbroken continuum that follows through our history. It's just that the firepower is more devastating. At the end of Vietnam War, 7 million tons of bombs had been dropped on Vietnam, many on civilian populations, more than twice the total bombs dropped on Europe and Asia in World War II. So just tremendous damage. The other thing to point out about the Vietnam War is the movement of Nixon between 1968 and 72. When U.S. troops were reduced and to less than 150,000 left, this is called the Vietnamization of the war, where what happened is that primarily American dollars and American air support, but mostly Vietnamese troops, continued on. And I think it's important to understand that this was by no means an effort to end the war. It was an effort to end the most offensive part of the war, which was U.S. soldiers dying. Not Vietnamese soldiers, but U.S. soldiers. And so, what we needed to do was to not have American soldiers getting killed on foreign soil. And that leads in really to the last thing I wanted to talk about. That's the latest development in American militarism and racism, which can be understood as a lesson learned from Vietnam, and that's low-intensity conflict. If you're here in a couple weeks, I would really suggest listening to most every session that Jack Nelson Pallmeyer does. He'll be coming here talking, I assume, part of the time about low-intensity conflict, but it's a very, very important development in military policy in this country, and it's the lesson that we learned from Vietnam, or at least military experts learned from Vietnam, that Vietnam was not wrong. The war was not a mistake. The mistake was that it cost too many American lives. The cost was too high for the American public to stomach it. So we need to find a new way to intervene in the affairs of other countries without U.S. soldiers coming home in body bags. Grenada was, I think, some small example of recovering the spirit of Vietnam without the loss of life. But on a much larger scale, right now, U.S. policy in Central America, is the official policy being played out, low-intensity conflict. And I won't describe this too much in detail, but just to say that low-intensity conflict, even without the Soviet threat, sees that liberation movements in the Third World are a threat to this country, and that they need to be suppressed. And it's war at the edges of the empire, primarily in the third country, to suppress revolution in the Third World. And low-intensity conflict is total war at the grassroots level. So it's a new kind of war that is not just military warfare, but it also includes economic warfare, psychological warfare, diplomatic warfare. And it's a comprehensive strategy that's designed to control the hearts and minds of, and as well as the economic life and the political destiny of entire people. So in low-intensity conflict, not only do you organize coup attempts to overthrow governments, but you also sponsor U.S.-sponsored terrorist groups and economic strangulation. That's literally what happened to Nicaragua. It was strangled economically by the Contras. Now, the most racist part, and this is the reason I bring it up, the most racist part of low-intensity conflict is that United States people will only tolerate this kind of policy so long as U.S. people don't get killed, and so long as only non-whites do the dying, and few U.S. boys come back in body bags. So that the challenge of low-intensity conflict is to fight wars without a lot of U.S. soldiers dying. So it's conscious policy now in this country for other people to do our dying in our wars, primarily third world people, primarily people of color. And that's why there really was such a thing as the Contras. It was other people fighting our war. We created them and paid for them to fight our war because we didn't see Nicaragua's government as legitimately elected government. And meanwhile, low-intensity conflict continues sort of its devastation in the third world, but most of us are unaware that it's happening. And I just read a sentence from Michael Clare, who has called this kind of warfare the ultimate in yuppie warfare. He says, it allows privileged Americans to go on buying condominiums, wearing chic designer clothes, eating expensive meals at posh restaurants, and generally living in style without risking their own lives, without facing the draft, without paying higher taxes, and most importantly, without being overly distracted by grisly scenes on the TV. I think we need to be aware of this. The one, I did this thing last year, and I think the one, if you have a pen to add on it, is the Panamanian War, which again, perhaps was part of low-intensity conflict. It's really, low-intensity conflict does not want to send American troops in. I mean, in Grenada, I think it's okay because it's a very winnable war with very few casualties. Panama was the same thing. How many U.S. casualties were there in Panama? I forget. 23? Does anyone remember how many Panamanian casualties?
250. Nobody knows.
250 was finally a number that was thrown out. For many, many days, there were never any numbers of Panamanian casualties. And just inherently racist reporting, it's now estimated that it's up to as many as several thousand Panamanian deaths as a result of the invasion. Again, it's sort of that sense that we were sort of doing something out of generosity for the Panamanian people, but they, in fact, experienced great loss of life. And the fact that that was not reported in the media, that there was no New York Times reporter in the battlefield there in Panama, where at the same time there were tons of reporters in Romania reporting on the violence there. I mean, I just think it just shows some of the racism that goes on in our media as well. I'm going to stop there and just open up for some questions. I do want to make some concluding remarks about what this means for us if we're concerned about social change, and especially my own perspectives coming out of the peace movement. But that was a very, very quick sort of survey, and it left out a lot and then assumed a lot. But maybe you could just comment whether that was helpful, new information, or if you have some questions about it.
A comment. Yeah.
it goes back a little further, but when I went to grade school, a little country school in Nebraska, you know, we were told that Columbus discovered America. And you think about that, what do you mean discovered? It was here, there were people here. It's sort of a silly, white-oriented statement is what it is.
And we're really going to be confronted with this in 2 years when there is going to be the 500th anniversary or celebration of Columbus discovering America. And I think churches especially have a tremendous task to decide how will we interpret that event. Is it indeed a celebration of the discovery of our country, or is it a mourning of an invasion, of an occupation?
Oh, I just want to say I have posted on the bulletin board of the Resource Center a statement from the Native Americans in this area on their attitude to the celebrations next year. So you might want to read it.
And they're going to be starting next year really from probably October of 91 to October of 92. And I would really try to pay attention to the voices of people of color in this country and what they're saying about how they interpret that. So that I think they can teach us a lot, especially Native peoples. Other questions or comments or arguments? I mean, it's one view of history. It's not the only one. Jean?
Is low-intensity conflict a word that the American military uses?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's an official policy. Yeah, and there's a lot written about it. I have a couple of maybe copies here of an article that Jack wrote about it, and includes a page of quotations about low-intensity conflict, both from the military and how they perceive it, and other people who are critiquing it. And there's probably tapes already in the tape library about it, and I don't know if Dan will do any teaching as well, but it's very much an official policy.
The term comes from the Pentagon. They have a spectrum of intensity of warfare, nuclear warfare being high-intensity warfare, the conventional warfare like in the World Wars being moderate warfare, and then any kind of guerrilla warfare or irregular warfare are called low-intensity warfare. But a lot of people who oppose low-intensity warfare have chosen to call it low-visibility warfare rather than low-intensity because to the people who are experiencing it, it's anything but low-intensity. I just remember a campesino, a native person in El Salvador, talking to me and saying, low-intensity warfare kills low-intensity people. It kills the people that don't make the headlines. But I was going to, another area that I think of the racism is the other side of U.S. militarism is what's going on right now with the lessening of tensions in East-West conflicts. Mm-hmm. And you're talking about media coverage. It's amazing to me there's been just incredible media coverage of what's happening in the democratization of Eastern Europe. But virtually no media coverage of the democratization of Latin America, which is in many countries like Brazil and Chile, U.S.-backed military regimes have been in power there for 30 years, 30 to 40 years. And there's actually more population of people returning to democracy in Latin America today than there is in Eastern Europe. Mm. And yet, you don't hear about it. It's nowhere. Talking about this tremendous upholding of democracy, whereas in Eastern Europe, it's all over the newspapers.
Except when it's Nicaragua, which is, you know, sort of a U.S.-backed victory for a candidate that we supported. I think that's a very helpful point. I didn't bring that out, but go ahead.
I wonder if what you people think about what I've been wondering. The military, it seems to me, we think of, you know, Pentagon, in other words, the upper crusts of it. It seems to me there is a self-perpetuation, just like big business. You know, I will get, and this was in Vietnam, I will get promoted if I do thus and such. And one of the terrible things in Vietnam is many career military people who had been in administrative things all their lives went to Vietnam to get this on their record with, you know, very little proper training, and was one of the terrible results over there where so many of our people got killed. But I think there is a self-perpetuation of war and conflicts by people who think, gee, if we had another good war, I might get promoted, mm-hmm. or that attitude.
I'm also going to talk about that in another way, that tomorrow morning, just in terms of men, and how there's also some, I think, equation of war and violence and conflict and masculinity. And there's some maybe connections there that we as men are sort of hesitate to talk about. There might also be sort of a macho as well, which you might be referring to. That's a whole other analysis I think is important right now.
What do you think about just war theory? I mean, throughout being a convicted pacifist, when you go through this long history, do you think the U.S. has ever fought in a war justifiably, where they've actually done some good liberating or whatever? I mean, how would you... I didn't really hear you refer to the church very much as you went through this history. Has the church taken good stands on the side of justice?
Well, it's difficult to say in terms of, you know, it depends on what you talk about the church meaning. The mainline churches, Plymouth, Delphic, Protestant, primarily have simply been legitimators of any foreign policy that the United States has had at the time. So they have either been quite supportive of those wars or silent. There have certainly been remnants or little groups of people, the sort of peace churches, and then groups within faith bodies that have been resistant. And then there have been the witness of conscientious objectors and others who have resisted intervention along the way. By and large, I don't think you can say that the church has been a very strong witness against militarism or in support of people of color in terms of domestic policies. I mean, the church, it's often said, you know, the church is still the most segregated place. 11 a.m. on Sunday is the most segregated hour of the week. So we just have a long, long way to go on that. And unfortunately, have been on the other side. In terms of just war, I think if you look at the just war criteria seriously, which the church doesn't, I mean, we don't teach it. None of us learned it in Sunday school. You sort of learn it by accident or if you really look for it. I don't think it's justified. I mean, certainly World War II, which comes the closest, had tremendous numbers of, you know, intentional bombings of civilians, which right there would rule it out as any kind of just war. And most people see that just war is outmoded because of the kinds of weapons we're using, and that all is fair in war. I think that's the attitude. Certainly there's some things that the just war might have contributed to. I mean, there were prison camps and exchanges of prisoners, and there was, the United States did do some work in restoring things that were destroyed after war, which is part of the just war criteria, that you need to build up what has been destroyed. But by and large, I'm not sure that we can say in any way that these wars were justifiable according to the church's own criteria. But people within the church who tried to resist war had a hard time. I mean, I work for an organization that has its roots in resistance to war by conscientious objectors since the beginning of World War II, and those people are very lonely people. That's why there has to be an organization, an independent organization called Lutheran Peace Fellowship, that supports those people, because they never were supported by the church body, even during the Vietnam War, until the very end. So I'm afraid it's not good news on that front.
You said that all is fair in war, but all is fair in peace also. The big farmers are buying out the little farmers. The big industries are buying out the small farmers. The large stores are buying out the smaller stores, running them out of business. So what is fair? What is fair when it comes to whether it's in wartime or peacetime? You see this happen every day. The big concerns take over the little concerns. You find it in small businesses where people fight for jobs. Strongest person gets the, I won't say the best person gets the highest job, but the person who has the most initiative or the most fastest talker can get the best job in a lot of cases, not all cases. But what is fair when it comes to peace or war?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I'd be interested in what people think. Is it really survival of the fittest? I mean, is that the way that we need to live in this world? And, you know, it's the strongest person economically, it's the strongest race, it's the white race against all other people of color.
It brings back an interesting perspective of my uncle who left the Midwest when he was about 21 years old back in 1934 and went out to California and made himself a bundle milking cows. And he used to visit us back in Minnesota where I'm from and talking about the everybody having the same opportunity to pull themselves up by the bootstraps. And it was that kind of attitude that we did battle over many times, but I don't know, just that one thing that comes to my mind in terms of an attitude about, in terms of, does everyone have equal opportunity? No, because we have, I work with people with disabilities and people who have less intelligence possibly or less ability to move around physically. They don't really always have the same opportunity.
And so, we in essence define what the goals are too. I mean, what I think that that's part of it too. What do people think? Responses to that?
I guess one thing that always puzzles me, which I've never really pursued lately, but there's a lot of talk these days about Japanese investment in the United States, and people are really against it. And I don't know how long it's been this way, but for the longest time, the most foreign money invested in the United States is from Great Britain. And I wonder why we don't make a fuss about that.
Yeah, all of a sudden when it's Japanese, we start complaining that they're taking over and mistrust. And I mean, it's interesting to see how those sort of racist undertones kind of pop up. And there's lots of those, I think. In Germany right now, there's tremendous fear among Jewish people with the United Germany and lots of neo-Nazi activity going on in Western and Eastern Europe. And it's incredible how that kind of thing pops up so quickly in very visible ways that we can see. I think underneath that, there's all sorts of ways in which that's played out every single day, and it doesn't go away. But there are times when it becomes very visible for us.
And certainly racism, too, is a part of, is certainly a part, plays a role in Japanese politics as well. It comes out in, I mean, they really take pride in their racial homogeneity mm-hmm. in the country. And
yeah, if you just look
referring
at...
Referring to the United States as a nation of mongrels and mm-hmm. some of those types of countries.
Yeah, and I shouldn't say that, you know, racism is somehow limited to the United States. I mean, just look at the situation of Korean people in the United States, or I mean, Korean people in Japan, or Korean atomic bomb survivors who were in Hiroshima at the time have absolutely no benefits, no medical benefits, like Japanese. You know, so they very much are into the purity of their own race.
Every country is. Every country's full of racism.
What I'd be interested in people's idea of why does racism occur?
Yeah, that's the question. I mean, this isn't something new. This has happened since the beginning of time.
I think maybe one opinion I have is people are in competition to some degree about getting ahead. If I can't think of any other reason that I should be ahead of this person, it's because I'm thus and so race and he isn't. That might be the basic reason, I don't know though.
I think since the beginning of time, man strive to outdo his fellow man.
Was it racism that caused Pearl Harbor?
In what way are you talking about?
Well, when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. You mentioned about dropping a bomb on Japan, but we didn't start that. The Japanese first started the war with the United States at Pearl Harbor. So was that a racial?
Well, it's a little bit incomparable in that, you know, it certainly was an act of war. Certainly it killed civilians as well as soldiers. It was not the first time that civilians were killed. Japanese had bombed other parts. Japanese had bombed, Chinese had invaded China. So it wasn't the issue of civilians being killed. I mean, that had happened previously. I think primarily for us, it was more of an economic, that they were threatening part of our Pacific empire. I mean, in terms of retaliation in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, I'm not sure you can compare it at all. Compare an attack on a military base to an attack on primarily civilian targets with a bomb that clearly had no ability to distinguish between civilians and soldiers.
Well, you see a lot of that in all the war.
Well, you never see nuclear bombs. Those are the only time those are
used. Never been used.
And still has devastating effects on Japan if you ever go there. I mean, there's still people dying of that bomb. Or that's not quite true.
I guess there's always been a question in my mind whether that particular bombing of Pearl Harbor was kind of a pretext that we were waiting for.
Isn't there a lot of speculation that we indeed had known about it coming?
There sure looks like there might well have been.
And we needed an excuse to
Kind of like the Tonkin Gulf incident, that then gave us a pretext to intervene more actively militarily in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to deny the suffering that happened at Pearl Harbor, because I know that, you know, U.S. veterans and other people who had relatives killed there or felt like that was an evil thing. I think we want to acknowledge it, but also to say that there's no way in which that justified Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I think unless we're willing to say no to Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that was clearly illegitimate and unjustifiable, then we haven't gotten anywhere. We're never going to be able to turn the tide against militarism. I think we clearly have to say no to that. That's a whole other session, and I have a tape in the tape library about the whole decision to drop the atomic bomb. There's all sorts of reasons that bomb was dropped. And just the fact that it was built in the first place meant that I think that it almost had to be used. And there's lots of evidence that it was used primarily as a signal to the Russians to keep them out of the Pacific theater. I mean, there's all sorts of those arguments. One last question, then I'll sum up here with some comments.
Just a quick question about, in your estimation, as a guesstimate, what percentage of our political leaders in this country, if they had heard your presentation tonight, would have some sympathy or understanding of or agree at all with